You're listening to the Britpop Show, sponsored by Creation Day Festival, playing the best and the rest of Britpop.
Now, what do we have this week? Welcome to the Britpop Show, everybody. This week, we have a bit of a surprise. I haven't really announced it. We have Mickey Bereny from Lush live with us in the studio immediately after this song. A bit of Oasis, Stand By Me. And the reason I'm playing it is because I've got this on vinyl and I've been playing it all week. This is Stand By Me.
Something new, dancing out the cold and wind and rain, don't know, the only
30 years since the release of Do You Remember the First Time by Pulp? But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk this week about basically Lush, because we have Mickey Bereny in the studio with us today, looking effortlessly cool, vaping away. Mickey, first of all, welcome to the show and thank you for coming.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm not feeling effortlessly cool, I can tell you that. I'm feeling a bit shabby, but I had to come back from York last night. Oh no, I came back this afternoon, but I think I had a bit too much cider yesterday, so I'm feeling a bit glued together, as it were.
Well, you know, these things, you have to do this in some respects, don't you? If you're a rock star, you have to live up to the image, don't you? Do you find that sometimes?
I'm not a rock star, no. I'm just an old lady. I turned 57 a week or so ago, so, and I'm feeling every single one of those years.
Well, I've asked people out on Twitter if you have a question for Mickey, let us know on Twitter. It's at the Britpop Show. We have some already come in, but I'm not going to start with those. I'm going to start at the beginning, if it's all right with you. What got you into music?
What got me into music? Probably just school. I don't know. You know, I think sometimes there's listening to music. It was probably school. You know, it's, I think music is a bit of a glue, isn't it? I moved schools a lot. So, you know, you're kind of looking for anything that can kind of get you in on the sort of, you know, get you friends basically. But I think getting into music as in going to gigs and stuff was, it was the 80s, it was London. I look back and I think we were in a very lucky position actually, because gigs were very, very cheap and there were many, many, many of them, and you could go out pretty much every night and see a band. So it was a great time. And then once you started going to gigs, everyone you met was in a band or playing in a band or, you know, putting on gigs or God knows what. Everyone was very involved. So it was a small leap to actually start a band ourselves.
You say it's a small leap, but I mean, you have to play an instrument or at least be able to sing.
I don't know. I think I might be living proof that that's not actually the case, but certainly not at the beginning. I think it was more momentum rather than talent at that stage.
But did you play beforehand?
Not really, no. I joined a band called The Bugs and played bass. And I had a week to learn how to play bass, pretty much. There was very DIY back then. You know, I think I kind of complained about how crap the sound was in venues. But I look back and I think maybe that was actually a bit of an advantage because you had an excuse for why it sounded so bad.
maybe. So Lush wasn't your first band then?
No, I mean, I was a bass player in The Bugs. Emma had joined a band called The Rover Girls. She was playing bass as well. But I think we both wanted to write our own songs. And so that's really the genesis of Lush. I mean, we'd written a fanzine together as well. So we were used to kind of working together, working in inverted commas. But, you know, just doing like... So, yeah, it just seemed a bit of an easy leap. It wasn't that big a deal. I promise you, it really wasn't. You know, like I said, there were a lot of gigs I went to that had a lot of quite terrible bands playing sometimes, but they all seemed to be having quite a good laugh. So you just thought, well, I can do that, you know.
Yeah. That seems a little bit like... I interviewed Rick Witter and he said... that they basically had decided everything about the band before they could even play any instruments. And so it was then decided that, well, he better go and learn some guitar because he's the guitarist. And so that he went off and learnt some guitar, and then the drummer went off and learnt drums, and they had it all planned out. They couldn't really play yet.
Oh, I don't. Well, we definitely didn't have it all planned out. We managed to come up with a name, I think. That was about as far as we got.
So where did the name come from? What inspired the name?
I think we were called, initially we were called Baby Machines. We never played a gig or did anything under that name. It was just a kind of placeholder, I think. Yeah. And then I got Meriel and Chris and Steve to join, literally by asking them one afternoon at college, do you want to join a band? Yep. Okay. Well, that's that done then. And then I think Emma had a mate who, so she suggested a name. She says, oh, I've got a friend who's got a name, but he hasn't got a band to use it for. So shall we use it? And we were like, yeah, all right. That sounds good. Lush. That was that decision made.
Done.
Yeah.
And that was before the days where you had to Google it and see how many hits came up with something that wasn't your name, right?
Yes, long before Google.
Yes.
Long before that.
Because nowadays, if you came up with a band name like Lush or Oasis or anything like that, then you just wouldn't work, would it? You instantly you'd get, for Oasis, you'd instantly get hits with, I don't know, fruit-flavoured drinks or women's clothing, wouldn't you?
Well, it does help if you just put band after your search
term.
That usually helps.
That is true. And of course, you were talking about so your early material. You were saying, well, you didn't really you were learning, let's say you were learning your instruments, let's put it that way. And you were effectively one of the first bands in what they called the shoegaze movement. Was that deliberate? Is there anything you...
No, I don't think, you know, I don't think any band, well, I mean, maybe some bands do, but I've never been in that position where you think, ooh, let's make music to join a scene. That's a completely alien concept to me. So I think even before shoegaze, there was the kind of scene that celebrates itself, which, as far as I can gather, just seemed to be bands that played at the Falcon and kind of borrowed each other's equipment and were friends, which is a pretty loose kind of, you know, basis to rope. I mean, you know, it was us, it was Silverfish, it was My Bloody Valentine. I mean, you know, bands that have like virtually nothing in common musically. I think the press were always a bit desperate to kind of create a scene so they could then, you know, flog copies off some invented sort of, you know, wave that didn't fucking exist at all, actually. Yeah. But so I don't think, you know, and with shoegaze, I just think, I mean, I genuinely think that we were, as I say, not the best musicians. And, you know, it's remarkable what a distortion and a chorus pedal can do when, you know, it's a bit of a tricky chord change. So I don't think we were after some sort of sonic landscape. We were just trying to make what scant kind of talent we had sort of hold together for the duration of a gig, really.
It, see, rather cruelly, I heard someone say about shoegaze that it was because rather than look at the audience, they had to look down at their instruments. And so it made them look, because you know, like you say, they were difficult chords that they were just learning. And so they, you know, just sort of had to look down and as a result didn't look up. And that's why they got the term shoegaze. I'm sure it's untrue.
It was termed by Andy Ross, who was like head of Food Records. You have to remember that he had Blur on his label, so there was a sort of competitive element. Yeah. And I think it was at a Moose gig, actually. And he was, you know, he was slagging the bands off. Oh, look at these bloody students with their floppy fringes. And so it was always a kind of term of derision.
Yeah.
It's just that I would argue that not every band has to sort of, you know, stand on stage doing high kicks and, you know, jumping around like some impish Damon Albarn. You know, it's like the idea of, you know, Kevin from My Bloody Valentine acting in that way is completely ludicrous. And what's wrong with bands behaving differently on stage? You know, it wasn't like nobody moved because they had to look at their pedals. Nobody moved because that's the way they were on stage. Yeah. You know, they were kind of a bit more blissed out and calm.
Well, Oasis owned that, didn't they? I mean, famously, they were just, I mean, I doubt Noel moved more than about a foot from where he started the gig. They just stock still bashed out the hits.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, oh my God, you can go back in time immemorial to look at bands sniping at each other. And it's, you know, you slag one band up off for doing something that you don't do, as if all bands have to be the same. I mean, I find the whole thing kind of idiotic, actually. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I would never have slagged off a Britpop band for, you know, jumping up and down on stage. I'd have thought, you know, I can remember going to see like Birdland or something and thinking, oh, they're quite fun. You know, it's not like everyone has to act like I do on stage. Why would you want that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, that's right. Now, I've asked you for a few suggestions for songs. And one of the songs you suggested was a Lush song, Heavenly Nobodies. Why did you pick that one? I mean, you picked a few, but why that one in particular?
That could be a bit random. I'm now trying to justify it.
Maybe it's just because you like it.
It's sort of, I guess I was just trying to pick, you know, things that weren't always like really obviously played. I think that is on Love Life, actually, which is meant to be our Britpop record. I don't know if it sounds like Britpop. It just sounds like garage to me. I think it was ripped off a Monkees song, the intro riff, I think. Maybe I ripped it off Circle Sky or something and then swivelled it around. But yeah,
I think what people need to do now, isn't it? They now need to listen to the start and decide which song you ripped off. And then we can all decide on the other side of the song. It's Heavenly Nobodies by Lush. After that, we'll be playing a lot more Lush and hearing a lot more from Mickey after this one. We'll be right back. Heavenly Nobodies by Lush. And the reason for we're playing that is this week we have Mickey Bereny in the studio. And she's far more delightful than I was expecting, Mickey, because I'll tell you some of this. You've written a book, and one of the things that they say about the book, and these are your own words, they say the conflict between her mouthy public persona and her thin-skinned private identity. So I wasn't quite sure who I was going to get today. Are you going to change halfway through?
No, I'm not going to change. I mean, you know, that's just, oh God, you know, it's blurb, isn't it?
It is, but there's something behind it. Go on, explain it.
I mean, when they say mouthy public, blah, blah, I just think, okay, I mean, I do swear quite a lot. I'm trying very hard not to at the moment.
Well, you feel free, because I can always adjust it. In fact, why don't we do that? There will be bad language between now and the end of the show.
I'm gonna try and be sensible, actually. But
please don't.
I don't know. You know, all of these things, it's like whatever you do, especially if you do it on stage, gets like magnified and shoved out there like it's some, you know, it's an extremist, isn't it? Because that's what sells. So if you stand on stage and you make one comment, then everybody calls you some mouthy, opinionated, whatever the hell it is. And if you at any point, you know, lash out and go, well, I just think, you know, that person's a dickhead or something, then you become thin-skinned and blah blah blah. So, and I think everybody is all of those things generally. You know, it's just a way to try and make you sound interesting, presumably.
Okay. Well, I'm going to move on to the next bit that it says on this description of your book, which it sounds like you didn't write. So let's the description, that is the book, I'm absolutely certain you did write. So it says being a woman, and it says it talks about the trials. Your book talks about the trials of being a woman in an infuriatingly male world.
I mean, you're right. I didn't write it. And that's not to slag off whoever did write it. It's that I am so bad at that kind of self-describing PR stuff. I think when I got asked to write the book, that's like one thing you have to do. Like you have to do a page, like a sort of pitch.
Yeah, an elevator.
Honestly,
pitch.
I just like just beyond me. You know, my pitch is like, well, I don't know. It's just a load of bollocks that happened to me. Like, what do you want me to say? You know, so someone else has to come up with that stuff.
Yeah.
And I just wave it away and go, yeah, fine, whatever you think works, you know.
Okay, but there must be something in the book about being in an infuriatingly male world. Is that something you experienced?
Well, I mean, it is, because I was in the music business, which was, you know, it's mostly blokes. But I don't know, you know, it was infuriating sometimes, and other times it was actually brilliant fun. You know, most of the time it didn't matter. I didn't mind having blokes in the band. You know, they were bloody great, and it made it really good fun. And most of the people we worked with who were male, you know, were immensely good fun to be around, and I was happy to be there with them, you know. But obviously, again, you know, when you come up against some, you know, sexist bollocks or whatever, it pisses you off. I mean, I'll be honest with you, there's many fucking women that I met who are a fucking nightmare. So, you know, it's not like it's an exclusive thing. But I think it was probably the male world thing is that kind of, yeah, you know, it's an ism, isn't it? It's when the expectation is you act a certain way just because you've got a vagina, I don't know, which is just obviously a ludicrous way to treat anybody. You know, I wouldn't treat men like that. I wouldn't think, oh, he's a bloke, so obviously he's going to be into football and pints and just be, I don't know, really moany when he gets the flu. I mean, you know what I mean?
It's cliches. It's a fair description. But So typically when I think of Britpop and I think of Britpop female icons, if you like, I think of Louise, I think of Sonia, I think of you. Did you ever get together and talk about that? Did you have your own little female club where, you know, you talked about what it was like to be a woman in like you say, an infuriatingly male world?
Not really. I mean, personally, I don't think there was that much camaraderie, you know. I mean, I didn't particularly feel it with a lot of the bands. I was good for, you know, I liked Pulp and I was quite matey with them until they got famous and they just thought I wasn't interesting anymore. But I think, you know, I think what was different was, I'll be honest with you, I do think with that shoegaze scene and the scene that celebrates itself and all of those ridiculous terms, there was a kind of camaraderie because you're all playing in little venues or you're going on tour together. And it was, you know, and no one was really, they weren't elbowing each other out of the way as much. I think clearly with Britpop, there was a lot of money floating around, a lot of competition. And I don't think that's a great environment for making, you know, good close friends. It could also be that I was just bored witless of it all by then, because I do think, you know, like, I think Pulp and Elastica were, you know, really good mates and stuff, so do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But I was, you know, I was getting into my late 20s by then, and I just sort of surveyed the scene and just thought, oh, just, you know, not into this really.
But as we're talking about the book, tell us about the book. What's it about?
What's it about? Yes. Oh my god,
elevator pitch.
I mean, the first half is probably, there's a lot about my childhood and growing up, and which is a little bit unusual for a memoir, especially a music memoir, because usually you get like a couple of set up chapters, you know, and then you go straight into the band. But I don't think the band comes into it till about halfway through the book.
Yeah.
And part of that is because I just wasn't into the idea of writing a particularly typical rock memoir. I think the first half is more entertaining. You know, I think the band stuff was fine to write about, but I'm not, you know, it's not a book about, you know, ooh, look at these sort of the hijinks of being in a band, you know, the drugs, the sex, the rock and roll. It's just not that kind of book. So okay, if that's the sort of book you want, buy a different book.
It's not often you get an elevator pitch that ends with buy a different book. Now, and you're doing a book tour at the moment.
I'm always doing a book tour. I tell you what, since that book came out, I've absolutely milked it, and I will continue to do so until people get very sick of it. But yeah, it's really good fun actually doing these book talks. It's a lot easier than playing a gig.
Yeah.
Just to sit there and talk about yourself for an hour. It's absolutely brilliant.
And so what do you, you go to a normal, like a Waterstones or something, and then people turn up and buy your book and you sign it?
Well, no, a lot of them are at kind of gig venues. So I'm doing, like, on the 21st of April, I'm doing a thing at the George Tavern.
Yeah.
In London. And that is, we're doing, you know, we'll play a gig, but the warm-up is just me doing the book and a Q&A. And that's often how it works. It's actually, yeah, it's almost like an evening with.
Do you come on and thank the support artist?
Oh, yeah, I big up the support massively, yeah.
So that's at the George Tavern at 7 p.m. on Sunday the 21st of April. It seems like you've got a few, you're going to France, aren't you? You've got Lille, you've got Barcelona, and then you go out to the United States. So these all gig/book events.
Well, the American stuff is just going to be music. Mm. So that's just the band. I think the Barcelona gig is a book talk as well, but the others are just gigs. To be honest with you, I got offered the Barcelona thing, and then the rest of the gigs were like, right, how do we get to Barcelona and back?
Yeah, it does look like you're in Lille on the Thursday and Barcelona on the Saturday. Sorry to tell you this.
Yes.
Now, we do have a lot of people listening in America, and just to get it out there. So 29th of May, you're in Los Angeles at the Fonda Theatre, and then you are on the 31st, you're in McGill in I don't know where that is. Shell Razor.
Nevada,
you're right, absolutely. Yeah. Then you are, 1st of June, you're in San Francisco. 3rd of June, you are in Portland. I'd love to go to Portland. Then you're in Seattle on the 4th of June. 6th of June, you're in Denver. 7th of June, you're in Chicago. 8th of June, you are in New York. And then you're back to Blighty for August. That's a pretty impressive tour for somebody who was, you know, Britpop a while ago. The support in America seems to be big.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lush always did quite, you know, reasonably well in America. I mean, again, I'll tell you what, all of this is kind of, again, you know, my planning strategies are never great. And so really the band, the trio, the Mickey Brenny Trio, can't bear saying my name in that, so I usually just call it MB3.
Yeah.
But basically, it came out of the book because we were doing book events and they said, can you do some music? And I was like, you know, okay, fine. So we threw this band together and we were doing a few Lush songs. And then we got offered, you know, we got offered a support with a wedding present, and then we got offered the Gang of Four tour, and then they were offering us more gigs. So we just thought, well, actually, it would be quite good to do this as an actual band and not just playing Lush covers.
Yeah.
So we've got, I think we've got a track coming out next month. It's so confusing because it's, like I said, the gigs get booked and then it's like, oh, okay, well, maybe we need to be a proper band and write some songs. So this is all like catch up. And yeah, the track, I think, is coming out because of the American tour. So everybody's been running around like headless chickens trying to get this track mixed and mastered and whatever in time. So it's all a bit panic stations. But, you know, it tends to work out in the end. I'm sure it'll be fine.
I'm sure it will. Now, we are going to have to talk a bit about Britpop. I'm going to do that after this next song by Morcheeba, Rome Wasn't Built in a Day. And I'm going to have to ask you about your big hit as well, Lady Killer. That will be after Morcheeba.
You and me were meant to be walking free in harmony. One fine day, we'll fly away. Don't you know that Rome wasn't built in a day? Hey, hey, hey. Thank you.
More Chiba, Rome Wasn't Built on a Day. And in the studio, we have this Mickey, who is becoming rapidly my favourite guest we've ever had on the show. And Mickey, I've set it out on Twitter. Any questions for you? Now, Big Old Pete, you remember Big Old Pete?
Big Old Pete?
Yeah, he says, his question for you is, why doesn't she remember giving me a drink of her Red Stripe when Lush was supporting The Cure in 1990 at Crystal Palace Bowl? Now, I think you might be doing you a disservice. You probably do remember that, don't you?
I know I don't. But the thing is that I don't want to burst his bubble, but, you know, it's not unlikely that I did that pretty much at every gig. I was always very generous with booze. So.
Well, it sounds like... Oh, no, yeah. No, you did. You gave him a drink of your Red Stripe. Now, he's talking about The Cure. It's a pretty big act to be supporting.
Yeah, that was quite early on, actually.
He's telling me 1990.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I'm not even sure if Spooky was out. It was very early on when I might have just been out. But anyway, yeah. So it was all a bit of a rush. You know, when we signed to 4AD, suddenly it was tours and all sorts. And that was a big offer. I was very, very nervous, I think. So, and also we were first on, obviously. So hence probably dishing out the drinks, because I think I got horrendously drunk afterwards. I was very excited.
Yeah. So, you know. Be. Crystal Palace Bowl.
Of course. Yeah. It was great.
So what's the best band that you've played with? Either they supported you or you supported them?
Oh, God.
I mean, there's been a lot. I know there's been
so... I mean, honestly, I really... Like, I genuinely loved touring. And touring with a band... You know, even bands that I might not have been that into at the beginning... Because I don't really like waiting backstage and getting incredibly nervous in some sterile atmosphere, I nearly always go out and watch the bands, because that's how you get excited about going on stage. It's a gig and you feel like you're at a gig, you know.
Yeah.
So I think by the end of any tour, I'd be kind of, you know, I'd find all sorts of reasons why I'd love the band that we were touring. And I'd spent most of the time, you know, being very excited. So. Yeah. I can't think of a band that we toured with that I thought were not exciting or great. Yeah. I kind of generally seem to have quite a good, maybe too good a time occasionally. Yeah, but apologies for that.
So you're not going to give me a name. You're going to be a politician and.
Of them. I mean, I actually can remember. You know, I can remember touring with Gallon Drunk, and they were supporting us, and there was a bit of, you know, people going, oh, why have you got Gallon Drunk supporting? They're too noisy. And why haven't you got another shoegaze band supporting? And I remember sort of going, why would you want another band that sounds like totally similar to us? Isn't that the point, that you go and see something like that you might not have ever encountered? And they were amazing, you know.
Absolutely. And so we're going to talk about Britpop now. Is it a coincidence that your albums are all a bit shoegaze and then... Britpop came along and you released a Britpop album? Did you think, do you know what, we're going to tweak our music style to suit this wave that's taking the country?
I mean, to be honest, if we were that canny about things, then the album before it would have been a Britpop album, because at the time I was going out with John Best. Savage and Best were the PR gurus.
We had Jane Savage on the show a couple of weeks
ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, all that stuff was already going on when we released Split. And Split was the most introverted, kind of, you know, non-starry album.
Yeah.
So we were absolutely not, you know, the sort of people who had our fingers on the pulse of some zeitgeist and thought that we should, you know, hitch our wagon to things. And actually... I think even with Love Life, I mean, you know, I do think that Love Life was the reason we did it with our sound man, Pete, the reason the sound was more direct and less produced and less layered, was frankly because we just kind of had enough of having producers that, you know, as much as I love those albums, we just thought, for a change, let's just get our sound man, Pete, to do it and, you know, make a much, because we'd been playing loads. You know, I said that we were complete garbage when we started out, but by then we had toured and toured and toured and we were actually really competent. Mm. So a lot of it was accidental. I mean, I do think where the kind of, you know, Britpop thing comes in is, look, by the time we put out Love Life, you know, that whole independent music scene had completely changed. If you didn't have a hit, you were dropped.
Yeah.
You know, that whole world had changed. So there was a pressure on. And I always think of like Single Girl, you know, which Emma wrote. And she always said, I probably would have written a song like that, you know, in previous incarnations of Lush, but it would have been a B-side. It wouldn't have been the lead single off an album.
Yeah.
But because that's what fitted with the moment, that's the track that gets picked, you know, and probably ditto Lady Killers. I mean, you know, you played Heavenly Nobodies. Probably if that, you, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's actually on Split now I think about it. Whereas it could have easily worked as just a Britpop track on the next album. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Hypocrite as well. But we always wrote quite a variety of different songs. It's just which one you pick, you know, because, hey, it's Britpop. It has to be upbeat. It has to have a, you know, catchy chorus. Okay, well, then pick those two songs, for Christ's sake, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, it's but funny you mentioned Lady Killer because Tom Sutton has contacted us. He said, were the awful men described in Lady Killers based on specific people, i.e. Blondie and muscles and long hair? And if so, can you now say who? It's still one of my favourite Britpop tracks. Now, this is probably the question you answer the most, isn't it?
It's the one I evade the most. Primarily, I mean, if you go and watch the video, it'll be pretty clear who one of the people is.
I'm going to name a name. I kind of regret
because I do think all the kind of like, who are all these awful men? Listen, you know, there was no kind of sexual assault or there wasn't anything appalling about it. It was just kind of a certain type of male behaviour. I just thought it was quite funny and quite amusing. I'm not going to say it wasn't irritating at the time, but I tend not to name them because they weren't, you know, I don't know them well enough to know if they were awful people. And the problem with meeting some of these people is that you can just meet them at a sort of crappy period of their life when they're a bit full of themselves. And they may be actually very lovely people the rest of the time. I have no idea. So I don't like crucifying people for, you know, what is effectively probably like one evening's behaviour, you know.
Now, do you object to me throwing out some names and seeing your reaction?
Well, I'm just going to ignore you because I just don't, I'm not going to,
okay,
I'm not going down that route. There are places you can find out who two of them are.
I heard, just for the listeners, because, you know, none of them will have Google, so they need me to help them with this. So I heard Anthony Kiedis of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, probably said his name wrong, invited you to a lap dancing club, and that got him a line in Lady Killer. You've gone quiet.
That could be true. Well, to be fair, I do actually write about it in the book, you know. So, yeah, you know.
Well, in which case, we'll stop now. If you've given those names away in the book, that's
I haven't given all the names away. I wrote that one because it's just out there. But, you know, I do feel a bit bad, to be honest, you know, because I just don't know the guy, really. I went on one tour and I just found him a bit irritating. But apart from that...
Well, look, Taylor Swift does it about all of the men she's ever met, right? So... One bloke who's actually doing all right for himself. I think he'll be all right. I'm pretty sure we won't. His lawyers will not be in touch. I think at that point we need to play it, don't we? Lady Killers. Here it is.
Go for it.
Hits from the 1990s.
Get the picture.
Hey, you, the muscles and the long hair, telling me that women are superior to men. Most guys just don't appreciate this. You just try convincing me you're better than them. So he talks for hours about a sensitive soul, and his favorite subject is sex. I don't even think he really wanted that ever. Christ, this guy's too much.
I wanna tell him
I'm as human as the next girl. I'd like her. I know.
the next one.
Blondie was with me for a summer. He flirted like a maniac, but I wouldn't bite. I'm weak and he was so persistent. He only had to have me cause I put up a fight.
Oh God, the boy had such an ego. He liked to talk about himself all day and all night. You'd think you're such a lady killer, but you were nothing special till you turned out the light. When he's nice to me, he's just nice to himself, and he's watching his reflection. I'm a 5 foot mirror for adoring himself. His 7 years back. A lady killer, super sexy mister, call it what you will. You would think you're such a lady killer. I just bet you're still there, posing in the mirror. Hey girls, you're such a lady killer, but we know where it's coming from, and we know the score.
What a tune, Lady Killers, Lush. And we have Mickey Bereni in the studio. We don't have much time left, Mickey, but we had another question in. Mark has messaged in saying, Lush sound like the Scottish band The Shop Assistants, who formed in 1984, a few years before Lush did. Were there any influences there?
Probably, because I do remember The Shop Assistants records right around the time that we were kind of forming. So I think they were kind of, what, 88, that sort of period.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of it. You know, there was a kind of sort of, what do they call it? Like, there was a sort of slightly shambling indie, you know, sort of, it was a little bit twee, but it had a little bit of power behind it. And there were lots of girls kind of involved. So I think that was probably quite inspiring, actually.
So
well spotted. Yes.
Oh, well done, Mark. I'm a bit annoyed you got a better question in than me, but anyway, we still got time. Now tell us what you're up to now. Following the band, you've had another band called Peroshka. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so Peroshka formed kind of after we did a Lush reunion in kind of 2016, and Justin, who was in Elastica, played drums for that. And then Perosh kind of formed after that. Me, Justin, Mick Conroy, who stepped in for the last Lush gig on bass, and then Moose, who was just, you know, sitting around in the living room doing fuck all. So I said, well, you might as well bloody join this band because it's literally on your doorstep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we just sort of... So we did two albums with Bally Union. And then, it's so interconnected because Ollie, who's now in the Mickey Bereni trio, he's in a band with Justin called Air Called, and they're on tour with the Jesus and Mary Chain right now. I'm going to go and see them on Friday at the Roundhouse. So, you know, yes, we're all kind of intertwined and, you know, hey, the scene that plays with itself.
I'm going to write that one down. I think that one's if the Daily Mail were listening, they would put that on the headline. You did ask me to play some Air Called. We've run out of time because you've been such an interesting guest, but you asked me to play some Air Called, No Reason to Lie. So if any listeners are interested in what Mickey's going to see, then Air Called, No Reason to Lie was one of the ones that she asked for. But we haven't had time, of course. I'm going to play some Peroshka as well. But we mustn't forget that. So you're touring, when you come back in September, you're touring with Gang of Four for a little bit, aren't you?
No, that was last year.
Oh, that was last year.
Well done.
So, do you know what? I was sitting there thinking, I haven't checked those dates. What year were they? So how was
no,
that?
No, I've got a wedding present thing. They do something called At the Edge of the Sea. So that's on the 10th of August. Mm. And then we are going to play some dates in September of our own. But I'm not even sure they've been announced yet, so I'm not going to go there. But the Gang of Four was brilliant. Oh my God, it was brilliant. It was so brilliant because it was proper teen kind of, I can't believe I'm going on tour with the Gang of Four, and they're literally playing these records that were my formative years. And it was, I mean, we were meant to be kind of sensible and, you know, playing and then driving to the next place. And we stayed every night because they were just brilliant. And and I've got a similar thing when we tour in America, because it's Lowell Tolhurst and Budgie from the Banshees. And I'm just a bit dazzled that we're going to be on a bus with them. And poor them, they're going to have to see my morning face. But I will be very excited, so...
And that's all part of the thing, isn't it? You know, I mean, you know, if you get to do this with all of the people that you effectively grew up with, that must be, I mean, at this stage, you must be thinking the fact that you're still touring, but touring, not just touring, touring with bands that you admired must be incredible.
Totally. I mean, it is. It's really exciting. That's one of the pleasures of going on tour. And, you know, I don't want to just be like, oh, you know, it has to be some mad famous band with some legacy. But even... you know, support bands, it's a real joy to sort of go and think like, God, I'm going to see this band like 8 times. It's going to be amazing.
Absolutely. And I think somebody, I think it was the Blue Tones, said something like that. They supported or Supergrass supported them. And they would always go out and watch them, because even though they saw them, you know, every night as a result, they just said that it was such an amazing show that it was a privilege to watch them perform every time.
And why would you not?
Yeah.
Free gig.
Yeah.
What else are you doing? Sitting backstage.
Well, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Not drinking because you can't. Like, no. Go out and watch the band. Yeah.
So we're going to play some Peroshka. Before we do that, so we're going to play Scratching at the Lid. Before we do that, it's time to wrap up, I'm afraid. You've been such an amazing guest. Thank you so much. So anybody listening, the book is called Fingers Crossed.
Yes.
And basically, where should they go if they wanted to find out more, if they wanted to see you play, or they wanted to go and hassle you to sign one of these books? Where would they find all that out?
I mean, there's all the gigs are listed on mickeystuff.com, I think, /live. So, yeah, that's all there. I mean, you know, just bring the book to a gig. I'll sign anything, you know, I don't really care. And... yeah, I think. Oh, and I think the book is coming out in like April the 8th or something in America. It's been impossible to get hold of, but it is going to be available. I don't know. You'll just have to look online. I haven't got a clue about these things.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
Like I said, we've got a lot of people listening in America. So if you are in America, make sure you rush out and get that book when it comes out next month. Mickey, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to leave everybody with Peroshka, Scratching at the Lid.
Thank you.
Hits from the 1990s.